kids. That's Segundo here. I apologize for the 10-day absence, but it seems the valet at my humble little caravanserai brought me vodka instead of tequila. I was left calling acquaintances to find out how to handle this 11th-hour switcheroo, and soon after I passed out, waking up in a shady glade just south of Livermore, I walked 10 miles with a throbbing head before I found a public telephone, only to get a pizza delivery service instead of the motel. This proved problematic for all parties, but I'm back now, and as proper restitution, we give you a two-guest show. Our first guest is Hillary Carlip, who knows nothing about cars, but our young roving correspondent deflected my questions about the size of her lip. So hopefully, our interview will sort this most important question out.
So I am here with Hillary Carlip, the author of Queen of the Oddballs and other true stories from a life unaccording to plan. Hillary, how are you doing today?
Great. Happy to be here.
Okay, first off, I think we should possibly sort of settle upon nomenclature, because you describe yourself as an oddball, and you defined an oddball in various other interviews as an eccentric, someone dubious of the tasteful and the restrained. But I think it may be a bit presumptuous to call yourself the queen. So what is this about the whole queen status? You don't really get this into this in the book, so maybe we should go ahead and talk about this.
Well, if you notice the title of the book, it's Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from A Life Unaccording to Plan. And Queen of the Oddballs is a chapter title in the book.
It is.
And it is about winning the gong show. And I was really surrounded by this posse of oddballs. And that day I won, and I even won after tying with Cheryl Lynn, who went on to have an enormous disco hit song.
Yes.
So I felt that day I was the queen of the oddballs.
Okay.
So I don't know if I could claim that title in all of life. But
so the actual sort of title of queen was bestowed upon you by Chuck Barris.
Absolutely. Yeah. Professed CIA assassin.
No, but also, though, you know, we should point out that also you earned the... A 10 from Rex Reed, who is among the most miserable human
beings. Right. No, not just a 10, his very first 10.
Yes, yes,
very,
very,
first
very
10
true.
Ever.
Very true,
yes.
Very true.
But
yeah.
He quickly bestowed his second 10 on Cheryl Lynn right after me, and that's how we got the tie.
Exactly, exactly. Well, yeah, I wanted to talk about Rex Reed, but I have no idea why. Largely because he's a total screw up, simply because the whole I saw like this Dick Cavett show DVD, and Rex Reed was on it, and like he was, you know, it was the Comic Legends DVD, and Rex Reed is there, and he's just totally being
comic
this like
legend.
little well, he's not a comic
exactly.
legend. He just happened to be on there because like it was the week before the Oscars, and he's sitting there being a total little punk ass and everything, and he actually got bleeped out by ABC because he said some
so
sort
funny.
Of like, you know, rumor about like some Hollywood legend or something like that, something about a paternity suit. So. And it's
you know,
yeah.
I think the present day, he was what Simon Cowell is today,
yeah.
Don't you think?
Maybe.
They're like the same person.
I know. And then the whole shoplifting thing. But anyway, I'm not. This is a literary podcast. I'm not going to be a gossip monger. Well, okay, so let's talk about this whole eccentric sort of thing. I think, you know, eccentrics can sort of be categorized as two types. Those who are sort of recognized by society as an eccentric, and those who kind of proudly announce themselves as an eccentric or an oddball. Which category do you fit in, and why?
Wow, what a question. I think I straddle.
Oh, okay.
I'm a straddler.
Well, this is a kind of indicator. Writing a book about it would be
exactly.
sort of, you know, suggestive of the latter.
Yes, it would. But I've also been considered an oddball and an eccentric all my life, and been treated as such, and really gone for it. And that's what the whole book is about. It's about like seeing your differences and going for it, and which I did at an early age, and really embracing that and not being afraid of it or feeling left out or anything, but just going fully with who you are.
What possessed you to sort of memorialize this? I mean, I saw the 8.5-minute little video that you also sent, and it lists, you had all these amazing sort of like scrapbooks. What kind of clinched you into sort of actually memorializing it into a book form?
Well, I had, as you mentioned, just saved journals and did journals with ephemera and everything all my life. Uh-huh. And I just felt like I had a really unusual life, full of a lot of escapades and adventures, and especially being in LA on the fringe of celebrity, but more so like B-list celebrity, which is much more interesting to me. Yeah. And I just felt like I, you know, I enjoyed the genre. I started getting involved with personal essays. I started a literary website, Fresh Yarn,
yes,
which was devoted to personal essays, and just felt it was time to get my stories out there.
Okay. Now, I guess, though, is the sort of, you know, writing about this, is this the kind of byproduct by having run-ins with Carly Simon and Carole King and Tom Hanks, or?
You know, it's hard to not write about that. But the run-ins, like with Carly Simon, I befriended her when I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
And the great thing, as we were talking about journals, is I got to include a lot of ephemera in the book. So the actual letter from Carly Simon in her own handwriting is in the book. Things like that.
What moved you to sort of like, you know, have like the sort of interstitial kind of like bulleted lists of all the sort of time periods and all that, as well as the sort of scrapbook feel? Because I at first had to kind of get used to it. I was like, wait, what the heck? You know, it's just like I thought I was reading a memoir. Then all of a sudden there's like these pictures of you with Art Linkletter, you know?
Well, that was part of it. And the front pieces, which are before each chapter, which go through what was happening that year politically, culturally, music, television. I was such a byproduct of pop culture, and it's so important to what shaped me and what shaped the book. So I just felt like a little shout out, like, let's set the scene, and here's the year, and here's what's going on personally and in the world.
Well, I know I read a review in the New York Times. Liesl Schillinger said that this was sort of like the Cliff Notes of pop culture or something to that effect.
Right.
And I guess maybe from that bullet list, were these points of references for you or for the reader or for both, or what motivated this? When did this come into play?
Exactly. It came out actually afterwards, and actually it was an idea my agent had. But
okay.
I thought it was really interesting, and I loved it because it's such a personal thing, a memoir, but also the themes in it are so universal in a way. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to set a stage and take someone back, like, or even if they did not live through that time, or if they did, depending on their age, just go, everyone has said that, like, oh my God, when I read that, I remembered exactly where I was then, and the song brought it back, or the political thing brought it back.
Yeah.
So just wanted to really set the stage and put them in that time.
I wonder, I mean, though, if you sort of have the kind of mind, because I have this kind of mind, where, like, a cultural event could sort of help me kind of time what I was doing roughly at
absolutely.
That particular point in my life. And
that and relationships.
Yeah.
I'm like, who was I with that year? Oh, yeah, that's how I remember the years. But definitely cultural events, absolutely. Uh-huh. And that's, you know, what I went for with the front pieces.
Okay. Now, this memoir sort of starts off with some run-ins. We have, like, Art Linkletter and Carly Simon and the like. But then it sort of starts to take on a kind of more confessional quality as the book goes on. You start to get into, you know, your father dying, your sort of, you know, burgeoning sexual orientation, your unexpected sort of soulmates, the mother's fixation with Vegas. And I just wondered, when did this sort of shift in tone kick in as you were writing the book? I mean, did you sort of find the purpose of your book as you were writing it? Or?
I did. Not only the purpose, but almost like when you do a memoir and you overview, you look at everything, it like puts it all into a perspective where I started going like, oh, is that what that was about? Like really kind of in creating an arc in the story, it's like the revelation of like what my life has been so far kind of took shape. So more personal things, more things about my family started coming up. But there were still the escapades even later in life and the run-ins with the fringe people.
I guess, though, I mean, if the scrapbooks were sort of the kind of impetus that sort of kick-started the book, my question, I suppose, is, I guess, when did you reach a point? How did you reach the point of like, oh, well, I have a sort of a narrative I'm tracking here. And did the lists kind of help you in tracking this? Maybe you can talk about that.
Well, it was interesting because of my love of the genre of personal essay, I started writing them as separate pieces. Mm-hmm. And again, it was sort of imposed once I sold the book. They were like, let's make this more of a memoir with a through line. So I really, it was at that time I looked and said, what does connect all these and what was my journey that I can weave through? Mm-hmm. So it was a conscious, like, let me look at these separate pieces and piece them all together.
I guess, though, I mean, but I'm specifically sort of trying to, I guess, get out of you the sort of, like, you know, when the kind of confessional quality sort of kicked in.
I feel page one is confessional, you know, even though there were more antics and escapades, like, and early on, too, with my brother being, you know, leading police on a high-speed chase and ending up in a mental hospital. I think it's woven throughout. So I don't quite see, like, oh, that came later. It feels like from page one that that's there.
I don't know. I mean, because for me, I sort of, it seemed very kind of comic, light sort of like personal essays, sort of, you know, like little light pieces. And then it kind of like shifts into this sort of like, oh, well, I'm actually chronicling my personal experience roughly maybe like around the 100 page mark.
Really?
So I guess I just was, you know, I mean, it seems to me that you would, you know, be cognizant of that because you were sort of really sort of charting the narrative of your life. And I don't know. I mean, did you sort of, was there a shift in the writing process, or?
I don't think so, because to me the confessional stuff was there early on, with being sent to a child psychologist when I was 8 years old to, you know, dealing with my family and feeling like I didn't belong anywhere or I was invisible and taking on other personas. It felt very confessional from page one to me. So, you know, maybe heavier things started happening with my father dying and things like that as, you know, I got older.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to hear you say there's a. I'm going to have to look at page 100.
Well,
I'll get back to you.
That's an approximation. I don't know. Page 98. How early did you start keeping scrapbooks?
Say that again.
How early did you start keeping scrapbooks?
I started keeping date books when I was 13,
which
chronicled what I did every day.
Uh-huh.
And then the journals that had ephemera in it more when I was probably 15 or 16.
Mm-hmm.
But the date books were such a trip to look back at and to see, like, you know, just the things I wrote. Like one day was go to Black Panther trial, hang with Manson girls, get flu. That was like all one day, which, I mean, even that I would write that at the time when I was 13 and write Get Flu, I loved the juxtaposition of that.
But I guess, though, from the years like 8 through 13, I mean, how did you sort of like, you know, draw upon that if you didn't memorialize it? I mean, it seems to me that, I mean, memory is a tricky sort of thing where if you write it down, you know, you're more likely to remember, whereas sometimes if you just like kind of like don't write it down, then you have to sort of ask your friends or whatnot.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, again, the ephemera, because like for the first piece, you mentioned the photos from Art Linkletter.
Yeah.
My grandmother took these photos of me appearing on House Party off the TV.
Yeah.
And that really triggered a lot and made me remember that whole experience. And the next piece when I was 11 is about going to Cotillion, these dance classes with all these celebrity children.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the programs from that with the pictures. And so even though I didn't have written words, there were things that still triggered memories and made me recall specifics.
There's also different sort of forms that you sort of work around with this. And there's the screenplay form. There's the scavenger hunt chapter where everything is kind of, you know, it resembles like almost a postmodern book. There's also the letter to Olivia Newton-John. I mean, why did you decide to write in different forms? I mean, what sort of possessed you to sort of like shift gears like that? I mean, were you having an issue with like your own particular voice writing something straight?
No, I felt like, how could I write a book about an unconventional life and doing things off the beaten path and have it be just in an ordinary kind of form? I mean, part of the book is I have done so many different things and never stayed on one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like I had to honor that even in the writing, like mixing it up, shaking it up. So it was a conscious decision.
However, one might counter-argue that actually writing about something that's unusual in a sort of deadpan kind of flat tone might in fact be more sort of conducive to breaking out the whole, craziness.
It might throw
people even more off guard. I mean, you know, I'm just, you know, did you attempt some of these particular chapters, like the screenplay chapter or the letter to Olivia Newton-John and any other voices? Or?
I did the Xanadu, the piece about appearing in the movie Xanadu, did do it in a different form, and it just didn't feel like it was, you know, I felt like I needed something to hook into it for me.
Mm-hmm.
So the letter became that. And this screenplay about Skirts, this movie I sold and was being made, I never, from the start, I thought, oh, it just has to be a screenplay. It just has to be told that way. So, and then there's another piece about my all-girl, all-ex-con band.
Yeah.
And that was told in kind of a guide, like how to be a rock star or how to be an imposter. And it kind of really flowed and just felt like, huh, I feel like telling it this way now.
Now, you had written a book, Girl Power, before this, I know, and I guess what possessed you to sort of shift from compiling essays from girls to sort of like, you know, this kind of telling the tale of your life?
Well, for years, Girl Power came out like 10 years ago, and then I did a second book about zines, which was the same thing of supporting people in telling their stories. And then Fresh Yarn, and everything I've done has been about supporting other people to tell their stories and encouraging that. And it just felt like, hello, you know, here I am telling everyone to speak out and use their voice, and I haven't really fully. So it felt like it was time for me to do that.
Got it. Now, what was I going to say? Oh, yeah, I mean, you actually had a blurb on the back here from Paul Rubens where he called this book mandatory reading. How did you get that blurb? I was curious.
I actually know Paul.
Okay.
And he knew I was writing this, and he said, I would love to read it, and if you want a quote. And I was like, absolutely, because he's one of my favorite oddballs.
Yeah, definitely. Well, the odd thing is I don't think I've ever seen a blurb by Paul Rubens.
No, it's his first.
Yeah.
Much like Rex Reed's 10, first.
Gotcha. Well, you also take Oprah to task for sort of sticking you in the crowd and making you look like Cruella de Vil, and when she devoted the entire show based off of Girl Power, your previous book. And though, to my mind, I think you might be the first author who's observed in print that your book didn't have any sort of, there was no effect of Oprah's show on the book's sales. This interested me because I'm wondering, beyond your own sort of personal dealings with Oprah, you feel that Oprah might be a threat to oddballs? Do you feel that she sort of chooses safe books? Do you think that maybe, you know, this whole sort of literature kick that she's often on, you know, which oddly enough, you know, hey, she got in trouble with a memoir.
Right,
which was
exactly.
Her grittiest book ever, you know.
Right.
Maybe you could sort of talk about, you know, this. Does, you know, I mean, I'm wondering why you didn't sort of go into this, because this, you took the whole Oprah thing quite personally. You know?
Well, I felt, you know, I also, besides wanting to bitch slap her, which I wrote in the book, I also have to give her some props, you know. And she, yeah, I don't think she was afraid of the subject or staying away because she devoted a whole hour to the book. It was like she's just focused on the girls that the book was about rather than, hello, it's a book, you know. So, but I do think, I mean, the whole James Fry thing was very interesting, her shift from fully standing behind it to taking it all back, you know. But she has done a lot for literature and books, and I don't believe she makes entirely safe choices. I think she's chosen interesting books to support, so.
Well, you know. It is, however, sort of guided by sort of sales, like she did The Summer of Faulkner, but that didn't actually sell, so she went to sort of a safe choice after that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, but well, at the same time, though, she called them my girls, as you point out in the book.
Exactly.
So, I mean, have you forgiven Oprah, or?
You know, she led me to inadvertently embrace my oddballness, and gave me a last chapter in my memoir, so sure.
Oh, so
I've forgiven her.
You forgive her? But do you think that Oprah sort of stands for some sort of ivory tower kind of establishment sort of figure? Or?
You know, she's such an anomaly, if that's the correct word for her. It might not be. But she's totally that. But then she is one of the few people who uses all her money to really help people. So you got to give it up for that, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, when you are sort of the mainstream sort of talk show queen, then, you know.
But there's plenty of other mainstream people who don't do a thing and who even do harm. So at least, you know, please, I'm not defending her by any means.
Yeah.
But she, I mean, in the piece, even though I talk about, you know, wanting to bitch slap her, it's more like it was just the whole experience. But I think, you know, she's very involved with herself, being on every magazine and whatever. But she also does a ton of good. And there's plenty of people not doing anything or doing no good. So I have to give it up for at least that, even though it's incredibly mainstream and who knows what's behind it, you know.
Well, the question, though, I mean, this kind of brings up a larger issue in your book in terms of you're constantly sort of like, you know, using cultural figures as reference points and your own kind of interactions with them. And, you know, someone might argue that, oh, well, this kind of gets in the way of you telling about your life as a juggler or a fire eater or, you know, someone who won even the Gong Show. But then, again, we deal with this sort of cultural kind of
backbone. Yeah, I mean, you can't talk about the Gong Show and not talk about Chuck Barris and J.P. Morgan and L.K. Summer and, you know, it's... But
I think this might be sort of what I was kind of getting at earlier about, like, things kind of kicking at the 100-page mark. Because for me, I felt that it was sort of like, it was very sort of... pop culture heavy, and then you started kind of releasing yourself from the pop culture. And I guess, you know, do you think that the, you know, by comparing yourself to pop culture, is that sort of a valid kind of qualifier to be an oddball, or, you know?
Not necessarily. And the, you know, I wasn't consciously like with the tone shift that you felt. I still feel like there's a lot of pop culture within the last half of the book, too.
Oh, sure.
It's just that that's what my life has been. Mm-hmm. And I just told my stories, never intending, like, to, you know, be the elbow, like, wink, wink, pop culture. It's just what I grew up in and what informed me.
Your existence is essentially sort of, you couldn't actually chart your existence without these.
Absolutely not. You know, starting as early as, you know, when I was really young, seeing Nancy Culp from the Beverly Hillbillies in my corner store buying meatballs and Alfred Hitchcock buying ice cream. It was like in my face where I grew up, just constantly around it.
Now, have you ever, I don't recall you actually mentioning if you had actually, aside from like trips to, you know, outside of L.A., but have you lived in like Southern California all your life? Or?
No, I lived in New York for a while. I lived in San Francisco here for several years.
Oh, that's interesting, because I mean, I didn't see many references to that.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why you sort of refrained from...
I definitely mention it, but the kind of seminal events that I focused on happened elsewhere. I'm mostly growing up, and then when I returned to L.A.
Huh. I mean, to what extent, though, is, like, would this memoir be sort of a Los Angeles kind of memoir, in the sense that you're writing predominantly about L.A. and Southern California culture? I mean, wouldn't it have been... I'm wondering why you made the decision not to sort of dwell upon these kind of other pockets of other locales that you sort of lived in, because it would have offered an interesting sort of contrast for what kind of, you know, drew you back to L.A.
True. You know... It just, the stories that came up felt like those were the stories. I didn't even think, like, only L.A. stories.
Yeah.
It's just those were the most meaningful. And I definitely mentioned San Francisco. I'm trying to think if I
think
mentioned
you
New
mentioned
York.
Going up to chase a girlfriend up in San Francisco.
No, I had lived there before I came down to
it.
L.A.
Okay.
For Olivia, for Xanadu. But I was here during, I mean, the one thing I remember mentioning for sure, because it's so vivid and I have pictures in my journal and everything, was being here when... Moscone and Harvey Milk were shot and killed.
Oh yeah.
And that was huge. That was a really big event.
Did you participate in the candlelight vigil?
I did.
Oh, okay.
I did, and it was awesome. I have pictures of it, but just that happened like hours later, there were, you know, 500,000 people on the streets with candles was just phenomenal. The community here was really something then in the 70s.
Yeah.
But there was no specific story that came up like, oh, this happened to me. You know, I was here for short periods of time. I was here for 2 years. I was in New York for maybe a year.
I mean, but what makes something like, so, you know, the assassination of Harvey Milk become I remember it's like a bulleted item in one of the lists as opposed to the, you know, that sounds like a really interesting story to sort of tell, to kind of provide you with some sort of, not necessarily a, I mean, because you're also a political activist, and you have done political activism, so it seems to me that this would kind of tie in a little bit to that, that, you know, this kind of oddball sort of thing that becomes almost sort of stark. Did you kind of want to get away from dark sort of episodes like that?
No, it wasn't anything I purposely did. It was just like, you know, there's probably 100 more stories to tell, and I'll just save them for the sequel.
Okay.
The ones that came, that ended up in the book, seemed like just... the track that I was going on.
Well, let's talk about this. Okay, so you've got like endless stories in your life. Did you know, what did you do to sort of figure out which story goes in the book? I mean, did you have some sort of system? Did you rate them from 1 through 10? Did you, like, you know, put them into a hat and kind of dramatically draw them? I mean,
it was very interesting, the process of writing this, because what I first did is went through every single date book and just wrote down things that either amused me or were seminal, and then from then on, I just kind of, you know, for me, writing isn't that organized or that thought out. It was really like what felt like being written and what moved me to write about. So it wasn't as random as like, oh, you know, picking something out of a hat. And but it was kind of where I was moved to write, really.
Okay. I mean, were there certain things that kind of got dropped from this book in the process?
There were a couple of pieces. In fact, there was one piece, it's interesting, that I turned in with my manuscript that my editor said, you know, it feels like the tone is getting too heavy toward the end, which is what you were saying, how the shift.
Yeah.
And she said, can you do something, you know, just lighter, more humorous? And the Las Vegas piece with my mother came in there.
Huh.
So out of her suggestion.
Do you imagine yourself maybe on a future book sort of dwelling upon some sort of dark and kind of serious territory? Because it seems that, you know, it seems obviously, I mean, you know, we're kind of discussing this sort of impulse I felt, and it seems, well, based off of this story, that maybe I have a little bit of justification for this.
There could be. There are so many, you know, and I feel the dark stories are in there, like you said.
Yeah.
There's, I think there's both, but again, I think with a book, for me, in the process of writing, it's like what feels like being written and what I'm moved to write. So it's not even a decision I would make, like in figuring out what stories are next.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to talk about you ended, you ended up gravitating towards the internet late in life, becoming one of the founders of Voxy. And given that you have like sort of adopted personas throughout much of your career, it seems to me that it's almost like you were meant to go to the internet, because the internet is very persona happy. and I was wondering if you might want to talk about this. Was the internet sort of an inevitable destination for you? I mean, also you, the Queen of the Oddball site is really thought out. We also mentioned, you know, a couple of your other projects that you've done as well. So maybe you can talk about what draws you, for example, to the internet.
For me, when we started the company, Voxy, which was 99, I believe, it was the first place I felt I could take everything I had done and put it in one place. Mm-hmm. From entertaining to writing to doing music to I oversaw all creative aspects. I'm a visual artist as well. It was like everything that had seemed so disparate before could be in one place, and that blew me away. That was phenomenal. So doing that felt like finally I had found something that brought them all together.
But Voxy, I know, also was one of the first Flash-centric sort of sites. I mean, hey, I was there. I've been on the internet from the early days. So I mean, you know, it seems also that there is an element of innovation that you're that kind of inspired you to sort of
absolutely. And it was, you know, it was one of those sites that was, you know, too late to cash in and make $1 billion, and way too early for the technology. I mean, we had Jennifer Aniston to do broadband shows with us, and like no one was on broadband.
It just
couldn't be done. And we had, you know, we were working with interactive television, which still hasn't happened like 8 years later.
Well, sort of though. I mean, we've got
more
some
so.
iTunes video, you know,
yes.
iPod video. So
definitely, but I mean, we were like really placing it as a network and really treating it that way, and got all this talent from Hollywood to do shows, to write shows, to produce shows, and it just was so way before at the time.
Well, it's Web 2.0.
Exactly. But we had a great time, and it from there, it really got me interested in, you know, doing websites and designing and building my own things. So,
I mean, what from there sort of like, you know, what elements of the internet sort of led you to do? Because I know you've also done like a lot of sort of like, you know, stand-up comedy and theatrical sort of things pretty much after your stint at Voxy. And I guess, you know, maybe you can describe what kind of led you into those that particular territory.
That actually came out of my writing, because there were so many spoken word events and venues popping up, especially in L.A., also here in San Francisco and New York. And since I had been focusing on writing and hadn't performed in a long time, I thought this would be a great place to perform again. So that's where I started doing these personal essays and performing. Like the shows I'm doing up here in San Francisco, they're like two are at bookstores and one is in a club, but they're very multimedia. I basically have been doing the Gong Show piece from my book, reading it, but then also performing the comedy juggling song that I won the Gong Show with. So they're very performance oriented.
What about other juggling routines? What about other juggling songs? You're not, I know there's just not just one particular
well,
set of juggling.
There's
the
one, the infamous one.
Yeah, but you know, maybe there's another one. There's like
sure,
you know,
who
Gong
knows,
Show number two. We don't have the Gong Show right now, but we have perhaps another sort of possibility to bring juggling back into the
absolutely
air.
Well, also at my readings, I do the an Are You an Oddball contest where talk about bringing the Gong Show back. I'm finding out all these fabulous oddball things about people, and there's fabulous prizes. And I'll be doing some online auditions coming up where people will submit their expression of being an oddball through video, artwork, photographs, writing. So that's coming up next month, too.
Well, are you from? This is actually one sort of interesting kind of question I'm going to pose to you. There was a book that was recently put up by Hal Niedzwiecki. Niedzwiecki? Yeah. He has a name that no one can pronounce. I pronounced it once successfully. But anyway, it's a book called Hello, I'm Special. And he actually has a very interesting premise behind the book, that the culture of special is actually based off of a lot of homogeneity. And basically, he sort of says that there is no special, because the act of actually being special or being odd is laced in certain kind of, you know, similar routines. So I'm going to actually put this particular sort of, you know, situation at you. If the entire world is odd, or if there are a lot of odd people, or there are more odd people, then how does oddness retain its kind of unique or sort of distinct kind of quality?
That's a really good question, right?
You're responsible with this whole audition things for like, and now all of a sudden everyone is odd. Well, what about people who are normal? What about, how do you sort of measure the sort of two, you know, the two parts on the spectrum?
Well, I think part of what has not happened is a lot of people haven't acknowledged their oddballness and have been resistant or afraid. I mean, I'm going by all the letters I get, because I get amazing letters like, thank you, I'm letting my oddballness and creativity thrive. To me, it's more about leading a creative life. And if everyone's creative, then right on. You know, if they can find that part of them to express, I say that's a beautiful world. So, you know, it's not like oddballs need to stand out or be special or be differentiated between normal people. It's just, to me, you know, express who you are fully.
Well, at the same time, though, when you're talking about express who you are fully, then we get into sort of things like American Idol that are sort of troublesome, where everybody wants to be a star. There's this potential sort of impulse that could reward on false merit, or like the bar perhaps is lowered, and the nature of sort of uniqueness or genius or whatnot is kind of like, you know, it's sort of, you know, downsized in its own weird way. It's the appreciation will, you know, possibly sort of diminish afterwards. So I mean, you know, what do we do to sort of like maintain a culture of oddness that is true and honest, while simultaneously not allowing everyone to be odd, because not everyone can be odd, just as not everyone can be normal.
Yes, this is true. You know, it's just not going mainstream, not selling out, just being, you know, I don't even know how to answer that.
Well, but what is mainstream and what is selling out? I mean, you know, if someone has a commercial for a very unusual sort of thing, is that selling out? I mean, you know, if you, you know, put your commercial, you know, I mean, if you put your song on a commercial, is that selling out if you, you know, play free shows or something? Or, I mean, you know, it's like this, you get into sort of like, you know, real absolute
values
here.
And I think it's all a personal, you know, barometer of where that is someone.
What is your personal barometer on this level? What is selling out to you? What is like, you know, integrity, oddball integrity? Tell me.
That's a very good question, and I don't even know how to answer it, because it's big. It's, you know, to me, I know when I'm being true to myself, and I know, you know, in terms of selling out, when I feel like off the path of my truth. So to me, it's just being true to myself. And if that, you know, homogenizes oddballness, if people start doing that more, you know, whatever.
But but then maybe, you know, like everything becomes sort of flatlined in the process. I mean,
I don't think that'll ever happen. Do you? Do you believe that would happen?
I mean, look at like what's happening with music right now. It's like, you know,
aren't there still the amazing musicians who totally stand out?
Well, there are, but it's like, okay, I'm 31, and I expected by now to sort of like have some sort of, you know, I expected to upgrade into jazz at this point in my life, and I have not. I expected some sort of like, you know, music to kind of come up and basically, you know, just totally like, you know, play havoc with my ears and basically say, you know, I wanted to say turn that down. So then I will gravitate towards a more sort of, I guess, higher music, so to speak, jazz. But that has not happened because there has not been anything, not from rap, not from hip hop, not from, you know, indie rock or anything that has really sort of like, you know, been like punk rock or anything. So, you know, I suspect it has something to do with this particular issue because now we live in this, you know, kind of highly sport specific world, which we didn't have 20 years ago. I mean, you know, I could go on and on about this. I'd rather actually I'd rather have you talk about this though, because it's like, you know, I mean, you've seen this sort of transformation, and maybe what was odd for you, you know, in the 70s or the 80s, is not so, you know, now everyone can have that by way of the internet, by way of things
like... I just think there's still always going to be exceptionally creative people who will do, even as things homogenize and get boring and sameness, there will always be the mavericks, there will always be the eccentrics, there will always be people doing a different way and raising the bar. I just can't believe that there won't be.
Well, I'd like to think that, but it's sort of, you know, looking at the music situation, for example. I mean, looking at the sort of thing where everyone is a star, this whole kind of Andy Warhol thing that people are now trying to sort of try right now on the internet, you know? I mean, you've got like a MySpace page too. I look at MySpace and I'm totally puzzled by it. But what was the motivation behind getting involved with MySpace exactly?
Well, MySpace has millions of people and millions of potential people I could share my book with, and it's a great promotional tool. And from it, not only that, I've hooked up with other authors that I never would have. And I started this memoirist collective with these three other authors.
Oh, yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Through MySpace, that are fantastic authors, fantastic people. We, like, now I consider good friends that I don't know if I'd ever have met them before. And we are working together we're doing these contests to help writers who don't have opportunity. We've had, we're on our third contest now, where the winner will win a read by three different editors at three big publishing houses. So this is stuff we're all conducting through MySpace and could not have done anywhere else. So I, you know, for what it's used for normally, I understand like the puzzlement of MySpace really, but we're taking it over and using it for our purposes and doing good with
it. You've been able to negotiate that terrain. It's just, you know, it's okay. Well, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, and that was, an interview that you had, Conversations with Famous Writers, in which you said that you were extremely nervous about people who were juggler haters and anti-fire eaters. And this confused me because I had no idea that there was this, you know, is there some sort of vitriolic kind of, you know, cadre of people who protest juggling with placards?
Well, come on, how many people hate mimes, right?
Well, but juggling is totally different, though, you know?
No, I was kidding in that, but...
Okay. I figured, but I mean, I didn't know if there was possibly some sort of justification. I mean, have you had people sort of, you know, quibble with your, you know...
Not
oh, you're
all.
Just a juggler.
No.
You're a sort of like, you know...
Not at all, but it's close behind a mime, you know? It really is. And there are definite mime haters. And I might even count myself amongst them.
Well, give mimes a chance. They're not all bad. I mean, you know, here, hey, we've got a mime troupe here that actually really isn't mimes. They named the San Francisco Mime Troupe, even though there's not a lot of mimes.
Remember, in my book?
Oh, you did put it in here.
They were the first people I started performing with
in LA. Yes, that's right.
When I was 15, yeah.
Got it.
They still at it?
Yeah.
Right on.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, Hillary, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
From juggling, we go to a topic that I am all too familiar with, getting fired. I don't speak of my own particular experience in firing very much. I like to put it behind me, unlike certain people but I was shocked that our next guest didn't ask me to contribute my own little anecdote about getting fired in the entertainment industry. I suppose I'll have to kiss the Andy Dick crowd or their asses to get any kind of writing work along these lines in the future.
So I am here with Annabelle Gurwitch, who I missed when she actually came to San Francisco. I was in D.C., and you came up to my city, and now you're going to D.C. again. What's going on? Are you like a month behind me? Or
I am. I'm stalking you, but obviously I've got my schedule wrong for my stalking, so I keep missing you. I came to San Francisco to do a screening of my Fire documentary and to do book signing. You weren't there, so I heard you were in Washington, so I made a trip to Washington, but I've made it at the wrong time, and you're not going to be there either.
Yes, but are you getting my love letters? That's the question.
I am. I'm actually going to show my film and do a signing at this thing called Take Back America. It's a progressive conference. So all the progressive people in America will be talking to other progressive people in America.
I mean, because I figured, you know, an organization like Take Back America would be a bunch of conservatives, you know, trying to take back America, you know?
No, they've got it. We won.
Yeah, I know, exactly.
We'll never get it, but, you know, it's a good effort.
Well, anyway, to the book. You are the editor of Fired, an anthology that deals with people getting fired, actually.
Yeah.
And I also understand that this was a documentary, but I mean, maybe we can sort of talk about this. What came first, the chicken or the egg, or the book or the documentary?
Getting fired came first. My own getting fired came first. That's the thing that came first. And I was really, this was like my first big show business firing. And like everyone who works in the entertainment industry, I mean, I know people get fired, but I never talked to even my friends, my good friends who I've known gotten fired. I always sort of shied away from the asking them the details because I thought it was sort of like contagious. I didn't really want to know what happened. It seemed too horrible. And so when it happened to me, I found myself just utterly miserable. And I really did think I was completely alone, which is not, it's ridiculous. You know people get fired, but you feel, the experience of it is that you feel really alone when you're fired. And that's what happened to me, and I started asking people that I knew if they had been fired, and people that I had known for years and worked with for years in the industry told me stories I had never heard them tell about utter failure and humiliation. Mm-hmm. And I really fell in love with these stories. And I decided that they should be heard by other people. And so, actually, the first thing that started was I started doing shows in Los Angeles at the Comedy Central space. We started performing them live with comedians like Dana Gould and Judy Gold and Andy Borowitz. And then I performed them in New York, off-Broadway. And then I thought we should reach a larger audience, so I put the book together. And really, it sort of became this crazy mission of mine that to share these stories with people. And it was actually while I was collecting stories for the book that I felt very passionate about the firings and downsizings and outsourcings going on in the rest of the country. And that's when I decided to make a documentary that looked at the wider picture of employment in America today. And you might know this, Ed, I do commentary for NPR, and I always try to pick stories. I do a combination of things. I do essays, and I do pieces where I interview people. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested in not only, pop culture, but in politics and sort of the zeitgeist. I actually did a piece today on NPR. I was recording a piece about the get-rich-quick mentality that I feel that America is in just an utter love affair with right now.
Well, any sort of quick fix solution. But to go back to the origin of the book, the sense I got when I was reading this was that it sort of started off as a kind of personal collection of, like, notes or, conversations you had with your friends and your peers. And I'm wondering, and also, it seems to me that you're trying to Howard Stern is the king of all media, but you are the queen of all sort of fired media, it seems. You've got theater, you've got film, you've got book, you've got all these this
you
sort
know,
of...
That was never my intention. I just want to, you know, it's funny. Some people have written things about, oh, it's like a cottage industry. This is absolutely not my intention. It's just that I'm a very obsessive person. Mm-hmm. And so I just, you know, I just take an idea and I'll just, you know, go with it till I feel I've done that. But it was not, this was definitely not like any sort of like, I'm going to conquer all fired media. The project just sort of gained steam because people responded to it, and it just seemed like there was an audience for it. And honestly, the feedback that, you know, people would come see the show, people would tell me their stories. Just ordinary people would stay after the show and tell me their stories. And that's what happened. And I have to say, from my interest is I actually really, I love essays and short stories, and I love storytelling. And I really enjoyed this event. Like, I showed the film in Tucson last week. We did a screening and a signing. And then people got up on stage, people in the audience, and told their stories about being fired. And I really do love storytelling of all kinds. And so that's what the film is. It basically tells people's story on a broader sense of America. No, absolutely, there was no, like, world domination of all things fired on my part. It just sort of turned out that way. But at the same time, you know, I'm also, you know, doing other projects. I wouldn't want people to think I'm sitting around all day on this, although I do spend a lot of time on it. At the same time, I was making The Shaggy Dog. I did another play in New York. I was just doing Boston Legal. I just did two indie films. So, you know, I try to, you know, doing a lot of different things, and I continue on at NPR doing everything from, you know, stories about science, which I'm sort of a science buff, to get rich quick schemes.
Sure. Well, I mean, it seems also, because you noted in an interview with Austin 360 that hearing about the miserable failures of others is a tonic. Now, I was wondering what precisely you meant by this. How can hearing about other people's misery restore one's vigor? I mean, maybe you meant the tonic scale. I don't know, but
No. Actually,
or maybe do you like gin or something?
To put things in perspective,
yeah.
That when you hear about other people having a similar experience as yourself, I believe, and just my experience in therapy would tell me that, you know, when you read stories about, I mean, why do people read memoirs? Why do people read personal accounts of triumph over illness or mental illness or other triumph over other people? It makes you, it can be very inspiring to hear about other people's failure or when other people meet their employment Waterloo, because you can tend to feel like this is something people don't talk about, you know, and it takes the stigma away, and you feel like you're not alone. It's a shared experience. You know, they say misery loves company, and I think it's true. Now, of course, I don't mean people should wallow in their misery, but it's a cathartic experience. I mean, actually, that was the original definition of, you know, theater from Greek time, was that you would go and you would see this drama enacted, and you would have this catharsis. There would be this emotional response, and it would be you would be through the drama experiencing that and sort of, you know, getting that out of yourself, catharsis. That was the original intent of all drama, and I think it's the same for why people find comfort in hearing a story that mirrors their own, or some sense, or tops their own, because I think being fired is one of those experiences that does tend to isolate a person. When you're fired, you often lose your whole community. And you feel like there's some shame about it, and people don't talk about it. And so for people to come out and say, oh, you know, I may now be the creator of Curb Your Enthusiasm, like Larry Charles, but I was a failed cab driver. I just think it helps people put things in perspective. I think it's a very natural human response to want to feel better when other people have the same experience. I mean, I think that is the beauty of any kind of group event, from 12-step programs to seeing Madea on stage.
Well,
although I've never wanted to kill my children.
Talking about sort of like the restorative or palliative kind of effects of hearing other stories.
Yeah.
A lot of the stories, however, in this book are from people who are in the entertainment industry or who are actors or writers who are often kind of like, you know, working from one gig to another. Do you think that such a focus is like an accurate representation of being fired? Like, can it apply to someone who like loses their livelihood and doesn't necessarily have the other job to fall back upon, or who doesn't have savings or living paycheck to paycheck?
I picked people in the entertainment industry for several reasons. One is this was my community that I work in now, and so being a something of a comedian myself. This was my offering. There are definitely plenty of books that really address things like Barbara Ehrenbreich's book, Nickels and Dime, that address many greater social issues. Although in the book, I have collected a lot of data about the executive pay versus average working pay, severance pays, what the sort of trends in downsizing and outsourcing. It gives us sort of a bigger perspective. However, this book is being offered as a form of humor therapy, as a way to find some relief. You know, Freud, when I'm paraphrasing Freud, said that humor is a high-order coping mechanism that helps you deal with a loss. And that is this particular offering. It's not the, you know, panacea or not the complete palliative that one would hope for when one gets fired, but it's what I'm offering is some humor and perspective. Now, the thing is, that I feel that makes the entertainment industry people that I picked in the book great stories are, first of all, a lot of them are comedians, and so they've managed to turn their firings into hilarious stories. But there's two things about that. One is that I have tried to pick stories from people's lives that I think are interesting because they're not just stories about, oh, when I was fired from that really big movie that I got paid a lot of money to walk away from. There's jobs from every kind of profession imaginable, from Judy Gold, the comedian's job working as a toll booth operator on the New Jersey Turnpike, to Patricia Heaton being fired as a crossing guard. You know, I think it's really interesting, and it helps people give perspective to know that people who are very successful, now particularly successful in the entertainment industry, and Robert Reich working as a pooper scooper at an advertising agency, and of course being fired once in the Solicitor General's office, that very successful people have gotten their start in all kinds of industries imaginable. As I mentioned, Larry Charles, one of the writers of Seinfeld, worked as a cab driver. Paul Feig, one of my favorite writers, was the Ronald McDonald of Toledo, Ohio. So it's a compendium of jobs that come from every type of job imaginable, not just, you know, show business jobs. And I chose that particularly. I mean, I could have had a book of just like fired from this sitcom, fired from that sitcom, because being fired in sitcoms is a daily occurrence. But I tried to pick jobs from all kinds of professions. Now, the thing that I feel is interesting about people in the entertainment industry is how resilient you have to be, because it's sort of like people who work in show business are experts in the field of rejection. And I felt that people in every industry can really learn something, because show business can be crushing. I mean, yes, I think if you're, you know, some hugely successful movie star who's insulated by, you know, gazillions of dollars, you know, the pain is, I'm not crying for anybody who's, you know, living in that kind of bubble. But you have to be, for the mostly working people in show business, you have to be so resilient, because you are fired continually. You're constantly being hired and fired, hired and fired. And you have to learn to be really resilient. You know, like what Jeff Garland says in his story. Of course, his stories are being fired from everything from the Specs music store for having a hanger on his head and 12 jobs at the Broward County Mall in retail when he was growing up, to being fired from show business. Left and right all the time as a comedian. He was just fired as the host of Fire Me, Please on CBS while I was writing this book. Mm-hmm. You have to develop a really thick skin, and I think in this economy, at this particular time, this is something that everyone in every industry can take a lesson from, because as we know, we don't have the same paradigm of work anymore in this country. My father was someone, in that time who, generation before us, you'd have maybe one job, maybe one company your whole life. Well, this kind of career is disappearing. Right now, I think the labor statistic is that by the time you're 32, an average American has held at least 9 jobs. Now, statistically speaking, over your career, you're going to hold a lot of jobs, and not all of them are going to work out. And I think that learning to deal with, you know, this kind of lifestyle of where many Americans are now finding themselves as freelancers, actually, unfortunately, because it's just a horrendous nightmare, you know, is a lot like show business.
Well, Annabelle, but it was a very great pleasure talking with you.
Oh, it was a really pleasure talking to you.